This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. Well, the debates are over. Campaigns are firing their final salvos, and, well, the voting's already underway. The end of the 2020 presidential race is in sight, maybe. And we want to know how this unique, unprecedented year has influenced how people in our region will vote. We'll start in Connecticut, and we've invited Professor Scott McLean from the Quinnipiac University Department of Philosophy and Political Science to join us, which he is doing via Skype. Hello, Professor. Welcome back to The Full Story.
It's great to be here, Tom. I hope you're doing okay, too.
Doing well. Thank you. Needless to say, there are so many unusual things going on this year, all of which could impact voting, I would guess. From where you sit, what tops the list of important issues for voters in Connecticut?
Yeah, that's not tough, Tom. It's the pandemic. It's COVID-19. I think that has disrupted life in general in so many ways, from schools to going out with friends and meeting in restaurants and taking a walk through your neighborhood. And in the big ways too, people have lost loved ones and had to suffer through this. And so it's the kind of issue that has to be squarely addressed by all the political candidates in every state. But I think in general, of course, related to that is always the economy. The economy is, has taken somewhat of a nosedive since the pandemic, and people are looking for work. Some people have lost their jobs, unfortunately. We're seeing a real increase in the number of people who are having trouble making ends meet, buying groceries, becoming more dependent on social services, whether it's provided by government or nonprofits. And we're seeing a lot more homeless people, and that's expected to increase this winter as we see shelters having to observe social distancing protocols, and there just won't be as much space in those kinds of institutions for people who are looking at after November 1st, possibly being evicted. Mm. So it's just going to affect life on so many levels, a pandemic, economic interaction.
How does an issue like the pandemic, which is clearly international in scope, how does that play in local elections around Connecticut, would you say? You mentioned the connection with the economy, of course, but just the COVID-19 issue itself, does that weigh on the votes for, well, most certainly members of Congress, but even when you get into local races, state and state representatives, state senators, that sort of thing?
That's a tougher question, but I think, it goes back to what I just said, that, the people who are most vulnerable become much more of a part of the conversation at door knocking and canvassing for state representative, state senator. You'll see changes in the way parties are campaigning. I mean, the idea of canvassing a neighborhood and knocking on doors is not as easy as it would have been. It's harder to find volunteers who will do that, but it's also harder to find people who will answer the door for a stranger and want to talk about these issues. So much more focus on phones and internet as far as campaigning goes. But when people talk about these issues for the state government, I think it really comes down to, are we opening again at the right pace? Can my kid go to school safely? Do we have the kinds of resources to make it safe to have in-person schooling? Mm. How do we deal with the stress on either side of that schooling issue when it comes to, having kids taking courses? We have large number of kids are finding out that haven't even logged in yet to their Zoom school courses. But we're also looking at parents who are stressed out, trying to manage that homeschooling with Zoom. And I'm one of them. my son's a high school student in New Haven, and he's New Haven Public Schools are about to open up next week for in-person classroom work. And that weighs heavily on my mind, and I'm sure it does with a lot of other people.
Well, with the issue put in that perspective, do you think voters are paying any more attention, closer attention to the campaigns this year?
Oh, yes. And unfortunately, I don't have the hard statistics from polling, but we're seeing nationwide an unbelievably high level of people paying attention. Far more, for example, far more younger voters are paying attention to this election. They were paying attention a lot earlier than is the norm. Back in the summertime, they were paying more attention than they were 4 years ago, or even 2 years ago, to these campaigns. And they're also expressing more commitment to vote. Now, of course, you know, we can only guess at the voter turnout, but they can be educated guesses. When we see high level of people paying attention, we see high level of people saying that they are definitely going to vote. And then we look at, surging voter registration and requests for absentee ballots like we're seeing in the state. It's a good indication that we're going to have a high turnout election. That figures into these campaigns and their strategies. High turnout elections, for the most part, will tend to favor Democratic candidates, because Democratic candidates depend on voters supporting them who are from backgrounds where it's a little bit harder to vote. You know, they're people that can't just take a day off of work or get transportation or childcare to come out and vote on election day. So we're seeing Democrats take advantage of those mail-in vote opportunities that we have now in Connecticut. And I'm not sure if that will give them an ultimate advantage on the final count, but we're bound to see higher turnout under these kinds of conditions.
I've heard reports about people who voted for Trump 4 years ago, opting not to this time and not to vote for Biden either. And then Bernie Sanders supporters who also won't vote for either major party candidate. And there were, I believe, a lot of people who chose not to vote 4 years ago in 2016. What's your take on that possibility in Connecticut this year? People just not choosing either major party candidate, choosing not to vote at all, or writing in someone on a third line?
We are seeing that, Tom. It is true that, Connecticut's not a swing state. It's not a battleground. The Democrats, the presidential level, federal level Democrats are expected to do pretty well, just like they usually do. And so the resources that might lead to a much more tightly contested race, like we see in swing states, it just doesn't happen here. And I think that gives voters the idea that, yeah, I can vote for another party. I can vote for a third party, or not vote for either Trump or Biden, just leaving it blank. But I think the national intensity of the race does filter down to Connecticut, and both parties are out there, pushing for the votes at the local level for local candidates, and there are some competitive races. And I really think that, none of this is hard science, but, we are going to see probably less of that kind of third party voting than we saw in 2016, when both major party candidates, you know, were not especially liked or trusted, and that people thought, well, maybe we'll take a chance and just vote for someone who hasn't had the political background. So it's a I don't think we're seeing that this year, and we're not seeing it mainly because it's so tight at the national level. There's no significant large-scale third-party effort going on. There is a Green Party candidate, a Libertarian Party candidate running for president, and I do know that people are voting for them. People in my neighborhood here in New Haven are voting for those candidates, but it's not like it was 4 years ago.
I wanted to touch briefly too on concern about security of the votes. We're hearing more and more about attempts possibly by Iran and Russia to interfere in various ways. Are you hearing anything about voters expressing serious concern about vote security?
That's the easy answer. I'm not hearing that. I think it's too early. It's too soon since the Homeland Security Department spoke about Russian and Iranian interference and the sort of hacking of voter databases. It's not mainly because Homeland Security was not clear on how exactly they could tamper with these votes. It's one thing to be able to hack into a database to get the names of the voters, and another thing entirely to, you know, change people's votes or you know, make all of the voting machines not work or intercept mail. That's just not happening. More likely and more, I think, probably just as dangerous is, you know, when foreign powers can sort of provide us with misinformation about the election, about the candidates. And we are seeing that. I mean, we're still seeing, Russian fake news. We're still seeing, disinformation. We're still seeing efforts to sort of crank up the anger and distrust among Democrats and Republicans through social media. So those things are real. I'm sorry I can't speak too much to the Iranians, but the Iranians really don't have the capacity that the Russians do for this kind of operation. The Russians have been at it longer and have the infrastructure to pull it off.
Well, I mentioned when we first began to speak that the end of the race is in sight, but the more we think about that, perhaps not so much. Might take a while to count all these votes. Professor, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. It's good talking to you.
We've been talking with Professor Scott McLean from the Quinnipiac University Department of Philosophy and Political Science. The suburbs have become a political battleground during this presidential election. But has all the partisan rhetoric influenced how people living in the suburbs will vote? To find out, we've invited Larry Levy to join us. He's the executive dean of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University on Long Island. Dean Levy, Larry, hello and welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. Based on what we've heard President Trump and former Vice President Biden say so far during the campaign, do you think they actually know enough about the suburbs of the 21st century to understand them? Starting with the president, he's tweeted that he would protect them from affordable housing developments and the people who live in them, as if white suburbanites should fear working class or poor people of color. Does this sort of thing resonate with, for instance, voters on Long Island?
Well, partisan talk doesn't play well, at least among the suburban swing voters. I mean, there are plenty of deep blue progressives and bright red conservatives out in suburban communities. But there's a preponderance of unaligned, moderate independents, maybe soft Republicans, soft Democrats, as we call them, who can be persuaded, far more so than you'll find on average in cities and in rural areas. So the hyperpartisan talk, the angry, rancorous tone doesn't play well with these people, and that's one of the reasons why President Trump is doing so relatively poorly, particularly among suburban women. These suburbanites shy away from rhetoric like that, extremism, or the perception of it from either party. It's cost the Democrats in certain elections, and it very likely could cost the Republicans this year. Now, you asked a really good question about whether these candidates know the suburbs. I thought, you know, about a month or so ago that Trump did not understand the suburbs, that his appeal from a so-called 50s and 60s playbook to racial animus and fears among suburban housewives was just not the reality that most suburbanites know now. The suburbs are much more diverse, almost as diverse as some of the central cities. And white people have their kids playing on teams and going to school with kids of color. They're working with and for people of color. It's not the same world. But then I realized when he never made the pivot, not from his convention, not during the debates, that he does know the suburbs, and he's only interested in the suburbanites who think just like his base does in rural areas. He's interested in city voters who think like that as well. In other words, Trump's strategy, whether it's the suburbs, the cities, or the rural areas, is to get out as many people who think like him, with whom his policy resonates. Biden is a whole other breed. Joe Biden really does know the suburbs. He commuted every day for 20 or 30 years from his suburban neighborhood to Washington. I know this is almost an apocryphal story, to be with his kids after the family tragedies. So he definitely understands, suburban thinking. He certainly understands the suburban landscape. And Biden is going after those moderate voters, many of whom went for Trump in 2016, or certainly enough of them to tip the election. Right now, those voters are back to the Democrats that they've been leaning towards the past 10 or 20 years. And Biden seems to his calmness, his middle-of-the-road policies, seems to appeal to these suburban voters.
Didn't Biden, during the first debate, say that the suburbs are by and large integrated? Is this accurate?
Well, integration is in the eye of the beholder. And if you look at the 20,000-foot view of a place like Long Island, for example, mm-hmm. you'd say, wow, especially if you're an old-timer like me who remembers, who started reporting in the 70s, the idea that more than a third of the population is non-white and 45% of the school children are non-white, you'd say, wow, that is a very integrated region. And it is true in terms of a region. If you drill down to the neighborhood level, Long Island is one of the most segregated places in the country. But there still is a coming together, even if it's not in the neighborhood, and in many cases not in schools. There's a much greater coming together of whites and non-whites in workplaces, in commercial areas. A white person is just as likely to have a non-white doctor, accountant, as a white one, depending upon where they're living. So if you want to talk in broad strokes, the suburbs are much more integrated. If you want to get down to the neighborhood level, they are not. And in fact, it's people, white people packed into these white suburban enclaves that still vote like it is the 50s and 60s and perhaps still think about race that same way. That's what Trump is after.
Which issues are important to suburban Long Island voters right now? What would you say is most motivating for them right now as the election approaches?
What's motivating suburbanites is pretty much motivating voters all over the country. It's COVID and the economy. When you're talking about college-educated, sophisticated, suburban women who have led President Trump, they are nuanced enough to see these all related. COVID and the economy are one big bundle of trouble for themselves, their families. Traditionally, suburbanites are very sensitive to taxation issues. They tend to pay very high property taxes because their incomes are higher. They fork over a lot of sales taxes. But COVID and the economy have just transcended taxes as an issue. And these are people who don't buy into the rhetoric that's coming from the White House that things are getting better because they see that their kids are still studying remotely. They see that they are still forced to work from home if they can still have a job. They watch their downtown main streets with boarded up buildings for the first time in a long time. And they are not happy. And they are smart enough to know that there's been a lack of leadership at the federal level and in some states, depending upon where they live. One of the reasons Andrew Cuomo's rating is so high, particularly in suburban areas, is because of what these voters see as his leadership on COVID.
Very often, as you were saying, local issues trump, no pun intended, local issues trump national issues when it comes to voting for offices that are something below the federal level. Is that going to be true this time around when it comes to the very local candidates? Will the national problems like COVID weigh heavily on in this case, Republicans on Long Island?
COVID and the economy is being seen, particularly among sophisticated, well-educated voters, as both local and global. They're not separating the two as an issue from each other, and they see it as both a local matter and a national one. That's a problem for President Trump in these areas because and for local Republicans running, because that's all voters really want to hear about for now. On Long Island, Republicans running for the state Senate are putting a lot of money into tying Democrats to votes in Albany, such as on bail reform or other progressive legislation that the Republicans think does not play well with moderate suburban voters. But the first, second, and third most powerful force in this election, down ballot, is going to be the man at the top of the ticket, which is President Trump. Anything that the Republicans are doing to try to introduce other issues is running against a very strong tide. Doesn't mean it won't work. Doesn't mean that the Republicans can't pick up a state Senate seat in a particularly close race where they found a strong candidate. But whatever the Republicans have to do locally has to overcome the animus toward President Trump, and particularly related to his handling of COVID and the economy as one issue.
We're talking with Larry Levy, the executive dean of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University on Long Island. Larry, is this unusual where the issues aren't being separated in this case by voters at the local level? They're seeing local issues and national issues as inseparable. Is that an unusual situation?
It's unusual for voters to be so overwhelmingly obsessed with national issues to the point where they're not even thinking about local issues that are more relevant to the down ballot races. But we have seen it, usually in times of recessions and times of major national scandal. During the Vietnam War, for example, there was an instance in 1964 on Long Island where the New York State Assembly Speaker, Joe Carlino, a Republican, lost his seat back home in 1964. He was washed away in the tsunami that was Johnson's victory over Goldwater. There are many Republicans who are still around from those days. Remember that and fear the same could happen in Biden versus Trump.
The news seems to change so rapidly these days, especially, say, compared to 1964. Does that change, does this rapid change, you think, affect how people were cast their ballots? In other words, are the issues that are important right now, will they be important in a year from now, a month from now? In other words, are Election Day issues anything more than like a snapshot in time?
COVID and the economy are going to be the most compelling issues that will overwhelm most others certainly in presidential or national election years, the even years. But that doesn't mean there won't be exceptions. And a barometer of that will be whether any Democrats in the state legislative races lose because of their votes in favor of bail reform and other progressive issues. I think there's an irony here that with the ability of social media, candidates using it to get out issues and to pound away at them one after another, it's created this grand cacophony for voters where they don't really listen to the individual issues anymore. It becomes one great wall of sound that either turns blue for them or red or pink or purple. And I think that it's the overall impression that voters get, which means more and more it's going to be about personality. It's going to be the awe factor of how does a Joe Biden make somebody feel? How does Trump make somebody feel? And that's going to carry through for quite a while.
Does that approach, the wall of sound approach, do you think encourage or discourage people from going to the polls? I'm wondering about people sitting out this election. What kind of numbers do you anticipate will do that?
I think you're going to see a very high turnout overall, but this constant wall of angry sounds that kind of drowns out individual issues and voices is probably going to keep a lot of people home. Trump's strategy is not only to get out every last voter who thinks like him, regardless of where they live, but it's also to try to suppress the Democratic vote. And he's getting a lot of help from the speed of which issues come out, the frustration that people have over COVID. Not everybody blames him for it. And that's going to be a real test of the Democratic organization of whether they can overcome the obstacles of the voting rights cases that Republicans have been winning and the like, and get their people to the polls. If the national and most of the statewide polls are accurate, the only way that President Trump can win is if he not only gets out the core supporters that live not just in rural areas, but they're all over the place, and through whatever means, suppresses or depresses Democratic vote in key states, particularly key suburbs.
I'd like to ask you, too, about congressional races, especially out east in the race pitting Lee Zeldin against Nancy Gorof. Do you expect the trickle-down vote to affect that race when it comes to people not voting for Trump this time around?
The first congressional district is a real bellwether of the Trump effect. 4 years ago, Trump carried the district by, I think, about a dozen points, and Zeldin by three or four. Zeldin since then has tied himself very closely to the president. Even went out to Oklahoma and attended that infamous rally at which Herb Cain was said to be infected and died 2 weeks later. And he hasn't, like some Republicans, tried to distance himself. If Trump falls too far in that district from 12 down to 3 or 4, and I don't see him losing in that district, but then there's a really good chance that Zeldin would not be able to withstand that wave. Trump has 12 points to give in the district. Zeldin only has a few. And if Zeldin, if Trump drops and Zeldin loses, that'll be the best example of the Trump effect you could possibly find in a suburban area.
Larry, we'd love to touch base with you again after the election, whenever the decision becomes official, to get your thoughts about what actually happens.
Larry, I'm happy to come on just anytime.
Larry Levy is Executive Dean of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University on Long Island. It doesn't feel like there's much to laugh about right now. And yet, comedians like Nagin Farsad are helping us process what we're experiencing right now. And she joins us now via Skype. Ms. Farsad, welcome to The Full Story.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. I need to add that in addition to doing stand-up comedy, Ms. Farsad is an author, a podcast host, a motion picture director and producer, an actor, a panelist on the NPR News Quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I do have to do some shameless promotion here. You can hear that program on WSHU on Saturday mornings. And all of this, of course, with a focus on comedy. And I read in your bio that you started your comedy career as a, quote, Cornell and Columbia-educated policy advisor for the city of New York. What's the connection there to comedy? How did that happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, growing up, I wanted to just grow up and be president of the United States. Like, that was my goal. I remember as early as, like, 9 years old saying that to my parents. So I really thought I was, you know, I had my eye on politics for a very long time. And I, as an undergrad, I studied theater, but also government. You know, I was always doing both things, mm-hmm. and performing in plays, but also debating, you know, with the debate team and all of that stuff. And went to grad school in public policy and African American studies, and ended up with a job at the Campaign Finance Board in New York City. And I was like, this is it. I'm doing it. I'm doing the good work of a public servant. Eventually I'll run for office. And I really, you know, I thought that was my path. But I was doing stand-up comedy and theater and sketch at night all the time. So I had just one foot in both worlds, and eventually the comedy part won out. But I still wanted to, you know, do stuff that was kind of relevant and not so narcissistic the way comedy is.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be able to kind of combine my passions. And so there is, you know, like an element of social justice to a lot of the comedy that I do.
Well, we're living through extraordinary times, very difficult times for many, to say the least. What's comedy's place right now? Is it a distraction, or is its role more important than that?
You know, it's interesting because I have a podcast called Fake the Nation, and it's a political comedy roundtable, and it's me and a couple of rotating comedians that confess about the news every week. And you know, and we also talk about culture, and we talk, you know, we take on grave issues like jalapeno poppers, yay or nay, right? So it's a mixed bag of a show, but I think in recent months it's been so, I mean, honestly, since 2016, it's been just, it's just kind of been an onslaught of, you know, national news coming out of Washington all the time. And then, of course, the pandemic has really, really added to that. And I think, for a long time, it was sort of, you know, yeah, you can make jokes about the national political climate, and that's fine. But I think my role in the last, you know, handful of months has been to be a voice of optimism. I think for some you know, reason. I mean, obviously, because of the pandemic, we sort of lost our ability to be hopeful. And I think that's something that comedy is providing. Like, we cannot all be in this kind of negative, steeped in negativity. The headlines are unceasing. But there's a way of looking at everything that isn't so completely awful. You know what I mean? And so we've been saying on my show in recent months, like, we're only doing optimism. We say it all the time on the show, to the point where we've got T-shirts made that we're only doing optimism. And so I sort of think that comedy has that role right now of providing an optimistic counterpoint to everything that's so negative.
When is it too soon to subject a serious situation like the pandemic, for example, to comedy?
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously, there's nothing about the loss of life that's funny, and it will never be funny, right? The loss of life will never be funny. But there's elements around it, elements of how we're living, how we're not showering, you know, all of that stuff, how everyone has gained a lot of weight from just being home too much and eating. The elements that are that have become this temporary normal that we're living in will always be subjected to comedy. That's what comedy is. It's just observing those things. I think we can all see ourselves a little bit in them.
And some people haven't gotten a haircut in 8 months, but this is radio, so I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, and for anyone that's in the audio medium, which we both are, it's a great time for us because it plays to our strengths.
You also call yourself a social justice comedian. How do you define that role?
Well, you know, early on, people used to call me a political comedian. I think because, like, I'm an Iranian American Muslim, you know, like most of your listeners, and I would do jokes about my family and stuff like that, and people would be like, "Oh, you're like a political comic," and I was like, "I mean, I don't know if like a joke about, you know, an Iranian woman farting necessarily makes me political," but I used to get that a lot, because just saying something from the point of view of a Muslim seemed political, even if it was completely something about me dating, you know. When I did stuff about politics, it wasn't really about politics. It was about social justice. Like, I wasn't doing jokes about, you know, how bad Obama was at bowling or whatever. I do feel like, you know, some of my stuff just had to do with immigrant rights and things that are sort of fundamentals, that aren't partisan. And so that's when I started kind of saying that I'm a social justice comedian, but I'm a social justice comedian, but I'm also like a, just like a dumb stuff comedian, you know, I run the gamut.
I would imagine on some of the topics of current events, when using that in connection with comedy, you must get some pushback.
I'm sorry. What do you mean?
I would imagine when you're in essence subjecting current events to comedy, you must get pushback, hecklers, so to speak, in the virtual sense to what you're doing.
Oh, you know, I mean, it's interesting because, like, you know, as a Muslim comedian and a woman, I'm sort of like a great target for hate mail and death threats and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I've definitely been subjected to, you know, my days of being heckled by readers of Breitbart and, like, you know, the Washington Times and some of those, like, conservative zines that like to, you know, that do like to quote-unquote heckle me. And so, yeah, I mean, it, in this political climate, I have some people that think that just a comedian who's also Muslim, who's also a woman, is just like too much. So I've definitely been subjected to that. But I also think that at the end of the day, they're just loud and really good at using Twitter. Most people just, you know, think of people like me as Americans and like to hear our stories. And I, you know, I say that as someone who's traveled, you know, I've performed in the farthest reaches of America, right? Like, I've performed in South Dakota, I've performed in Wyoming, I've performed in South South Carolina, multiple red states around the union. And the fact of the matter is, when you approach people with love and comedy, you're most likely to get love in return. And so I think one of the things that the current climate sort of makes us forget is that most people aren't full of hate and rage. You know what I mean? It is a very, 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 very small minority, and they happen to just take up an outsized place in the internet, but they don't actually represent the country. And it's so hard to remember that right now, but that's the truth. And I say that, like I said, as someone who's traveled and performed in so, so many parts of the country.
I'm speaking with Negin Farsad, a comedian, author, podcaster, and a wearer of many other hats. Have you been able to use your humor to help people sort of process the racial justice reckoning that's going on right now around the country?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because it's a reckoning that's going on around the country right now. And it's and I'm so glad that people are like learning about it and taking a minute. I mean, the number of friends I have that are like, I just bought a book from James Baldwin. I'm like, great. You know, that is we haven't seen that before. I mean, I'm married to a black man and I have, a biracial baby. And so for me, the issue of racial justice has been front of mind for a really long time. Unfortunately, for some people in America, it's taken a little bit longer. And I think sharing stories like mine, like having to introduce my immigrant parents to a black man and having to explain to them that, like, this is all cool, and watching them, turn from people who were, like, maybe a little concerned that I was dating a black man to now being absolutely in love with their son-in-law and marching down the streets and saying Black Lives Matter. I mean, to see that evolution and to be able to tell those stories in joke form, I think is helpful, because these are just normal people that are also learning about racial justice the way the rest of the country is. And so to be able to share those stories, I think it does help people process this, because it's a story of how people can evolve. And I've seen it happen, like with my own family. And I think we're seeing it happen in the country, and it's exciting.
You've had so many projects going on, books, films, TV, writing the podcast, quiz shows, TED Talks. I'm wondering, have you been able to continue performing live, doing your stand-up through the restraints of the pandemic?
Well, I mean, you know, Zoom has provided some digital outlets, Skype, the Google Hangout, all of those online platforms. There's been shows on those. And so luckily, I've been able to do some performing on there, which sometimes can feel like you're doing a soliloquy to a ghost. And then other times, you can at least see some people laughing and it feels like you're in the room. In New York City, there have been a lot of outdoor shows. I think you might see those in cities around America. So go to your outdoor shows. I've been doing some in New York through New York Comedy Club, and it's just been fantastic. And also, I think, to see people, laughing together in a safe and socially distant capacity, like, you can feel the energy of the room shifting. You can, of the rooftop, you can feel the energy shifting where people are like, oh, this is some normalcy, as long as the weather permits, like, I highly recommend seeking out some of these outdoor live performances.
I think it was Bette Midler I heard say recently that she enjoyed performing on Zoom because she didn't have to share the stage with anybody when doing that. What are you working on right now?
Well, right now, I mean, I am just really deep into the elections, just doing my part as a citizen. I just signed up to be a poll worker with the Faith the Nation is doing a hashtag influence the polls. I'm trying to get around the country to become poll workers so that people who are in higher risk groups, who we kind of typically rely on to be poll workers, don't have to do it. So, for people who are out there, I hope you consider signing up to be a poll worker, signing up to get people to register to vote. Fake the Nation right now is just really heavily into that
And so I'm doing that, and I write about some of my thoughts and experiences with the Progressive magazine. I have a column there called Hemming and Hawing. So I'm keeping busy with the writing, podcasting, and the live outdoor shows.
I've got just one more question, but it's sort of a big one, and with just a few seconds left, it's probably not the place to put it, but let's do it anyway. Why do we need comedy?
Okay.
Why do we need comedy?
Why do we need comedy? You know, here's the thing. I think you need something to jolt you out of your mood. And a lot of people, like, inertia takes over, and we're in this negative space, and we're just, like, used to it, and so we keep doing it, and we're like, we'll listen to, like, a sad song to, like, keep being sad, or we'll just, like, just be frustrated and annoyed and just do that all day long. And you need something to jolt you out of it. And sometimes that thing is exercise, and sometimes that thing is singing really, like, belting at the top of your lungs to Bette Midler. And sometimes that's just, like, throwing on some comedy and laughing and just getting out of that mood that you're in. We all have the capacity to kind of be more optimistic, to be happier, to laugh more. Like, we are in the middle of a pandemic, but we do not need to stop living, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I think comedy reminds us that we still have the capacity to enjoy ourselves within the limitations. And the limitations in the grand scheme of things are temporary, you know? So we just got to get through it. And we might as well get through it with laughter.
Nagin Farsad, thanks so much for your time and for joining us on The Full Story. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was so great chatting with you.
It was fun. So what do you think? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org. We're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. And that's it for our program today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.